Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Yes, you are listening to the Science of Sport podcast. First of all, to explain why my voice sounds strangely unfamiliar, because it sounds strangely unfamiliar to me. I've spent the last couple of days commentating and announcing at the Ultra Trail Cape Town, which is a three-day event which over various distances they run around the southern peninsula of Cape Town, including a 100-miler, which is more than 100 miler, actually, 166 kilometer race is included in this Ultra Trail Cape Town. There's also 100 kilometer, there's a 55 kilometer, 35 kilometer. So I spent about 21 hours on the mic over the last 3 days. So that's what my voice sounds like it does. So my apologies if I sound a bit weird for the rest of the podcast, and particularly with our interview, which we'll introduce to you a little bit later. But Ross, how have you been? You've been traveling around a bit and spending a lot of time on planes and hotels, haven't you?
Yeah, I got back from London from that. We spoke in our last podcast about the concussion meeting that was in Amsterdam. I spent a week after that in London with the PRL doing some academy psychology support
work. PRL?
Premiership Rugby.
Right.
Yeah. They're developing a position around psychology support for academy players, and I chaired a session and so on. Then I came back for about 5 days. Then I had to go back. There was a big Shape of the Game meeting where they got all the high performance directors and coaches, the CEOs of the major unions, referees, the key guys in world rugby. And sadly, it is mostly guys. Unbelievable. Like, there's no women in that. It's actually a problem. But it was a meeting over 2 days to discuss the shape of the game. There's this real tension between the spectacle of rugby and the safety.
Yeah.
And so I was there representing the player welfare side. Unashamedly, I say, listen, I'm here about player welfare. Mm. And of course I care that the spectacle looks good, but my priority is player welfare. The other folk, the coaches, their priority is winning, obviously. And then the media and the business folk, their priority is the product. And so there's this three-way tug of war basically going on, and there is tension there. It's interesting to sit through and hear other people's perspectives and how, you know, like, we've got all these cards. We spoke in our last podcasts trying to change behavior with cards. They're saying that that's ruining the game. We're saying unless you do that, the game will be ruined by the safety thing. So anyway, it was a very intense couple of days, and then I flew back a day later. So that was my week, was sitting on planes, my back and my sinuses. And it's the end of the year now, so we made it.
I think that's one aspect of sports that I think we should probably look at some point, is that the impact of travel on world-class sportsmen must be enormous. I often think about those tennis players that travel literally to every part of the globe throughout the year, and that must take its toll on the body and the strategies.
Unless you're like a top 10 person with invites, you're not traveling business class, right? So you're in the cattle class with me, and it must be very difficult. Mm.
I always think back in the rugby days when South Africa used to travel to New Zealand and Australia when we were playing Super Rugby before we joined this new competition with England. But, you know, there must have been a massive problem with jet lag and how they cope with that.
Yeah, big time. And there's actually a lot of cool research. It would be interesting to look at. Yeah. When I was with the Sevens, we used to go, and I remember one trip was from here, Johannesburg, Sydney, Sydney, Auckland, Auckland, Wellington, play the tournament in Wellington. So you get there like 5 days before, play the tournament. Then on the Monday after, fly right around the back end to Los Angeles, then to Vegas. And then you fly back via New York, literally around the world in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't sleep normally for about 2 months after that.
It's crazy.
Yeah. My circadian rhythms were completely sizzled. So
that's
what you do in sports.
Absolutely.
And then 6 weeks later, you start getting on top of it again. And now it's time to go to Hong Kong and Singapore. Cool. Let's mess it up again.
So one of the things that caught my eye was actually something you sent me. We mentioned it very briefly after our last podcast off air, and we thought we'd talk a little bit about it. And it's kind of a bit dated, but I still think it's relevant, is that the New York Marathon this year, they were the first marathon, as far as I know, to have a separate prize category for non-binary athletes. And you sent me a tweet today from Mario Mucci, who's a very well-known commentator in the world of marathon running. And she talks about how the prize money for the non-binary athletes had changed. And there were different changes to it. I don't really understand what these changes were, but one of the things, and it sounds incredibly un-PC to say this, but I'm flabbergasted to think that there is now a non-binary section, because what stops somebody, and maybe I'm erring here, but what stops somebody who is a reasonable athlete claiming to be a non-binary and taking home the $6,000 that the non-binary person that won a legal marathon? It doesn't make any sense to me, because as far as I know, physiologically, it is just an identification rather than a biological consideration.
Yeah, and I'm with you. So I'm not interested in being PC, sure. I'm interested in being physiologically right.
Yeah.
And you say it's dated. It's dated insofar that the actual race happened about 2.5-3 weeks ago, but the results keep changing. And this is the whole, well, it's not the whole problem, but it's one of the obvious predictions you'd make, is how do you verify these results? Because it's basically a claim that a person has to make. And okay, they've said in their policies that when you enter, you have to identify your gender. And presumably there you tick a box online or whatever it is that says I'm non-binary, and you make yourself eligible for this category. And the money is not insignificant, right? No. I mean, actually, the money relative to what the winners of major marathons make, for sure, it's small. But I mean, this money here in South Africa, that would be your biggest races wouldn't pay out this much to win the whole thing. And so they obviously recognized some of the issues, and they made a 3:10 limit. You had to break 3:10 to get the prize money. So you could be the fastest non-binary self-identified person in 3:10.01 and you wouldn't get the money.
Yeah.
But what's happened is over the course of the last 2 weeks, people who were previously listed as second then moved to third. And so they had to update the results, presumably because they found someone else who claimed to be either before or after non-binary. And on the 24th was the last one. I think this is the tweet I sent you. Mara tweets, the non-binary results been updated again. Daniel Lemelman, 3:04.41, has disappeared from second, now listed 804th in the men's division. So he doesn't get the $4,000. Now Zachary Harris gets second, winning $4,000 for 3:09.41. So was the previous guy, did he not indicate it and claimed it after the fact? I don't know. But the whole principle of non-binary is that you just declare that you don't want to be part of the men's or the women's race. You want to be part of this new separate category. Now, if you took at random, and it would have to be random, 100 men and 100 women, the best man will be better than the best woman by 10 to 12%. The 50th man will be better than the 50th woman by that same difference.
Yeah.
So the moment you create a category that ignores biological sex and allows only self-ID, you are by nature almost certainly going to select preferentially for males. That's the problem. It's a discriminatory category, and it's discriminatory against females, because the man who comes 804th, okay, and he's now no longer second, but he was, Daniel Lemelman, runs 3:04, he's 804th in the men's race. Guarantee you 3:04 puts you way higher than 804th in the women's race.
Yeah.
So in order to be equal in a non-binary category, you have to be very good as a female and relatively mediocre as a male.
Yeah.
How is that possibly fair? It's ridiculous.
Yep.
I mean, I suppose you can make the case that it's better than allowing males to enter women's races. but it's an arbitrary, you know, they might as well have categories next year for people wearing red shoelaces.
Yeah.
That's what they should do. They should say blonde hair, red shoelace category.
Yeah, it does. I wish I just could read. I try to look for some details here as to what the justification was it from the New York Marathon. And it just feels to me like it's just, you know, it's obviously very PC to award these sort of things, but there are so many. I think on Facebook, for instance, there is something like 71 different categories that you can list there. So why aren't there 71 categories at a New York Marathon? And once you start this, you're going to start all sorts of trouble here.
Correct. Why stop ever?
And exactly.
Again, there's no issue. I'm sure you agree with me. There's no issue with someone identifying as non-binary in their lives. They can identify how you please. But when it comes to sport, where the biological effects, the physiological effects of biological sex are so profound and significant, creating a category like this is just basically saying, here's another way for male athletes to win significant prize money.
Yep.
And unless you're an exceptional female, this one's not for you.
Yeah.
But you can be a relatively mediocre male, and here you go. Here's 4,000. That's the second. 5,000.
I think it was 6,000 for the winner.
Is it six? So it went 6-4-3.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
No, it's...
It's a category it's that... It's a category. It doesn't by design exclude females because, you know, we said afterwards, Ahead of Stain came 11th or 12th. It was confusing.
She said 11th, but actually she was 12th. Yeah.
See, she was 45 minutes faster than these non-binary athletes.
Yeah.
40 minutes faster to come 12th in the women's race. She got how much prize money?
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
Maybe she had her expenses covered.
Yeah.
So you can run a 220 something and get nothing, or you can run a 304 as a male and walk away with 5-6. Nah, come on.
I know what I would do if I was Khadab, but anyway.
Just declare differently next year. You see, that's the problem. Like, just declare it.
Yeah.
And no one can ever challenge it because it's a self-ID thing. You can't question it. That's the rules of engagement are you never get to question someone's gender.
Yeah.
So then go and win the money.
Yeah.
Oh, it's,
anyway. I'm sure we'll get a couple of tweets about this from the certain fraternities, but we'll see how it goes out there. Anyway, so let's move on to our subject of the day today. And we have a very special guest, Nick Chadd, who is the head of sports science and strength and conditioning at the Portuguese giant soccer club, Benfica. And the great thing about Nick is that he's unique in the fact that he hasn't spent his whole life working in soccer. He's worked with Olympic athletes. He's worked in rugby as well. He's worked at Manchester City. And he works in a very specialized space in the fact that he looks after the very top end of the club at Benfica, but also looks after the overall club, which includes rugby at Benfica as well, and the juniors and the upcoming and the different teams within that big organization. So Nick's a unique guy. And what I found about this discussion and the thing that I took out most from is an amazing amount of passion and respect for the abilities of the players that he handles. He talks a lot about the fact that he's incredibly, he admires how good they are and how brilliant they are because he's a fan. You know, he's a fan looking after the best players in the world.
Yeah, and we've done a couple of these now with different experts in the science conditioning space in different sports. And almost always, in fact, every single time that I can remember, we end up talking about relational, emotional aspects. And then I'm trying to pull it back towards, like, let's talk some data and so on. But actually, that's the stuff that really matters. And so when you hear that passion and the enthusiasm that Nick has for the players, I mean, at one point we ask him about data versus instinct, and you can hear his answer to that question. But it's that kind of, I want to know the person and I want to understand the player, and then I'll be able to give them the best advice. And the data matters, no doubt. And I'm fully invested as head of sports science, which is what he is, but I'm actually there because if I don't have relationships and trust, then like all that data becomes potentially very not meaningless, but actively harmful.
Yeah.
Very interesting always to hear that. So
just to give you some background for those who are listening to our podcast, I know that Ross watches a lot of soccer socially and that sort of thing, but it's one sport that I really struggled to get my head around.
How's the
over
World
the
Cup
years.
Going?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. I mean, if you ask me how the World Cup's going now, I wouldn't know because I don't watch enough football.
Yeah.
And I keep on calling it soccer. it's one sport that I've always struggled with purely because maybe I don't understand it as much. I think I struggle with the histrionics around the sport, which I think most people do. And I think, you know, the fact that you get, you know, one goal can change the game, and the fact that you can dominate but then potentially lose kind of goes against my ethos around sport. I think the best person should win. But I mean, Ross, where does your football knowledge, passion, where does it sit?
When I was very young, football was my first sport. I mean, when I say very young, I'm talking before I even got to high school. I used to love it. I was obsessed. Collected all the stickers and kept league tables every week.
Did you have a team?
Well, my dad's team was Tottenham, and I liked Liverpool back then. That was in the 90s. It was the late 80s and into the early 90s. They were probably the best team. So, you know, when you're a kid, you support the winner. And I remember keeping like little scrapbooks and posters on the wall and 90 World Cup, sorry, and then 94. 90 was in Italy, and I remember building the mascot. His name was Ciao. And yeah, so I have good memories of football. Now I don't watch as much of it. There's just not enough time to watch all the football there is. But when there's a big game, I watch it. And I've been watching the World Cup. It's a little difficult to set aside some of the off-field stuff, the corruption that brought the World Cup to where it is. Yeah. Some of the stuff that's happened before. You've watched, have you finished that FIFA documentary, by the way?
I'm on episode number 3, FIFA Uncovered. It's on interesting, Netflix, yeah.
And I mean, in the lead up to this World Cup, Infantino, the new president, spoke. And you know, where Sepp Blatter and before him Joao Havelange saw themselves as like statesmen and political leaders, this guy genuinely, I think, thinks he's a religious leader. It's like a new level of self-deification. He's like the Pope and Buddha and the Hare Krishna and the Dalai Lama, all rolled into one, come to deliver soccer to save the people. It's like there's a serious like delusion in football. And it's quite hard to like see coverage of that plus shock results. Saudi Arabia beats Argentina and only consider the football.
Yeah,
I mean, they're claiming 3 people died building those stadiums. The official figure is in the thousands.
Really?
Well, not the stadiums, but the infrastructure for the World Cup. Yeah. It's like, so there's so much going on. But now that the tournament is underway, I'm watching. I mean, I watched last night, Germany-Spain, really good. On Saturday, Argentina-Mexico was maybe the most meaningful game so far because of Argentina's loss. And so as we get into as we sit here recording and maybe this comes out, we would have been in the last throes of the group stages. Now the knockout begins. And there's great jeopardy in it. You know, what you say is a weakness, one goal can win it, is actually one of the things that makes it really enthralling. Because you'll get big, big surprises. We've seen them. So yeah. So I'm enthusiastic. Not as much as I have been in the past, but I'm enthusiastic and I appreciate like the chance to get insight from experts that maybe make it a bit more engaging.
Well, here is a very interesting insight from a man who understands about the physicality and the sports and conditioning, Nick Chadd. So, Nick, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. I know that we're talking to you right in the middle of the World Cup in soccer, and obviously what's unique about your situation is you're very involved in the world of soccer, but you have experience outside of soccer with having been with the Wasps rugby team, and also, as you mentioned before this podcast, having worked with Olympic sports before that. Just give us a bit of a précis about your last sort of 15 years and where you come from and how you got to the position where you are now with Benfica.
Sure, yeah, no problem. And thanks for having me on. So yeah, last 15 years, so studied university in the UK and did my master's at Sheffield Hallam University, and did a short internship in football at the very beginning of my career, and then quickly moved into the world of multiple sports, and into the UK Olympic system through the English Institute of Sport, where I worked with swimming, disability swimming as well in the Paralympic world. Athletics with a group of pole vaulters going into London, and then transitioned into rugby. So transitioned into team sports with London Wasps at the time. And then out the back of that, moved back into the Olympic scene, but in more of a rehabilitation role at the intensive rehab unit, which is based just outside of London, joint venture with the British Olympic Association and English Institute of Sport. And then stepped into the world of football, where I went into, was lucky enough to get a role at Manchester City, based in their football academy, as the head of sports science there. And I've since now ended up in Portugal, in Benfica, having an adventure out here with my family and learning every day about a different way of working and style of working and culture.
As we've said in the intro to our podcast today, and both Ross and I probably come to this podcast with compared to our other sports that we know a reasonable amount, soccer is one of the areas where I certainly find myself very challenged in terms of understanding the sport itself. But just take us through what your job is at Benfica. What role do you play and what areas do you fulfill there?
Sure, yeah. So my title is Head of Sports Science for Benfica. And I'm not sure, I'll just explain the context in Benfica. We have obviously the men's first team and the men's academy football. We have the women's first team and women's academy football. And then we also have sort of a multiple sports model where we have professional indoor sports, where we have 5 professional indoor sports male and female, which includes sports like basketball, futsal, and others. We have an Olympic project as well, where we support multiple Olympic athletes across the country. And we also have a professional rugby and rugby academy as well. So my role actually is more of an umbrella role, which sits across all of that, which sits across the department. And so we have 35 sports scientists at the club across all those different sports and different areas.
Sure. So when you say you have those 35, what is the role of the sports scientists? I mean, obviously it's not just soccer, as you just mentioned. Is it, just give us the role that you do. What areas do you look after?
Yeah, so fundamentally, sports science is the umbrella term. Rightly or wrongly, I think there's probably a little bit of ambiguity around terminology in our industry anyway. But so basically, we're trying to optimize the physical preparation of the athletes to perform. And that is fundamentally, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do, all of the staff in our department, whether that's through different functions within the area. So whether that be through more of a bias, through monitoring, through actually physical preparation, maybe in the gym, on the field or on the court, obviously recovery strategies, and then obviously being integrated into some return to play processes as well, which are vitally important.
So, I mean, I want to kick off some of the more technical questions. Because on this podcast, we talk a lot about endurance sport. We understand the idea that athletes, you know, train for an event, they get to a certain point, they peak, and then they do the event, and then they recover. Tell me how different it is in the world of soccer, football.
There are fines every time I say soccer.
Yeah.
I'm going to listen to this podcast and make notes. 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's going to be a very expensive podcast if I'm not very careful. But
Christmas lunch is in
football, how different is it in terms of the physical preparation? Do soccer players actually peak in a way that we would understand as endurance athletes?
As endurance athletes, I'd probably suggest no. What I think is amazing or fascinating about athletes in football, coming from the experience that I had outside of football and then coming in, is their ability to maintain such a high level of performance through such a long period of time. So I think something I did a lot of work to try and upskill myself in when I came in football was trying to learn about periodization, essentially the organization of training. And it, to a certain degree, goes out the window a little bit, especially on a long-term basis for players in football. For multiple reasons, obviously the competition schedule is incredible. You know, when you look at, you know, I think that there's been some work by UEFA and the Champions League teams, and, you know, Champions League teams were averaging maybe 5.3 games every month, you know, and the top, some of the other teams were averaging 6. And take any sort of Olympic sport or endurance sport that, you know, trying to compete at a level with that sort of scrutiny 6 times a month, it probably doesn't exist. For basically, what are we talking? Probably, 10 months of the year, 9-10 months of the year. I think the other thing as well, like within the culture of the sport, which is really interesting to understand, is obviously quite a lot of flux in terms of whether that's coach changes or players shifting across different clubs. So, you know, trying to really dig down into, right, how can we get this player better and how are we looking at it on a long term as much as a short term? Your long term and short term sort of periodization models, for want of a better term, change compared to they do in a traditional endurance sport.
Yeah, and I suppose in the context of the World Cup, how do you periodize for a World Cup? Because the players are owned by the clubs and the international teams have very little access to them. So they kind of get together and then have to play at as close to their highest level as possible in that window of a World Cup. In that regard, the fact that this World Cup's in a different time of year, has it changed in any way what you know of the players' preparation going into it?
I think the biggest level of change has come from the competition schedule. So obviously they've got to squeeze, for want of a better term, got to squeeze all of the fixtures, the domestic fixtures for the clubs in. So it's been, you know, for our players here in Benfica specifically, it's been very, very busy. You know, there's probably averaging two games a week, you know, up until the World Cup. So in terms of managing that is a real challenge for the players, because obviously they've got competing goals as well. You know, they want to be prepared for the World Cup. Ultimately, they want to perform for their team.
Yeah.
So I think from a club perspective, it's quite reasonably refreshing to have a bit of a break through the midway through the season. Obviously, most of my experience is in the UK, and I know that, you know, especially around Christmas and New Year period, which will still come into play over there, is incredibly busy. But, you know, from a player perspective, you are literally going straight through and trying to perform, which is a real challenge. But saying that, sometimes a change is as good as a break, someone once said to me once. So, you know, like that change in environment, that change of stimulus, the change of voice can actually be, you know, quite refreshing for players, I believe. So, so it's really interesting. I don't have the answers around how to manage it. And it's incredible how the players manage to maintain such a high level of performance the whole way through.
So a couple of things on that, if I may. Like when the World Cup schedule comes out, and we knew what the schedule, not the schedule as in match by match, but the fact that it's in this window starting in what would have been mid-November, running through towards the week before Christmas, would you have sat down with the coaches and the S&C guys, the sports scientists at Benfica and said, right, we anticipate, and I would imagine a relatively high number of your players are in the World Cup, representing different countries. Do you sit down and say, all right, we're going to work with the player and we're going to manage that player a little bit differently leading into it, because half our squad won't play football for 4 weeks and the other half will play the same amount as normal. How do you juggle that load discrepancy between your squad members?
To be honest, I think what we do is we've obviously looked at when it is. It's the same for everybody. And we know that the break's coming. We know who's going to be involved before or not. It's obviously not official until they announce the squad. But in terms of managing them into the World Cup, if it can be done, it can be done. I'll probably say in the UK, it's probably slightly more challenging in terms of the league is less polarized within the Premier League, for example. So, you know, any team can lose to any team. The league's slightly more polarized here, where we have some really, really strong teams, including us at the top, which are, you know, are in great contention to win the league. But the reality is some of the teams won't be in the top half. So maybe in terms of managing that against the opponents, it is possible. But really, the objective of the club is to win every single game. Yeah. So we want to try and do that. And then what we try and do is with the player is develop and optimize the best individual recovery strategies or management strategies for them in between games and then leading into the World Cup as well. And I think that's something that's taken on a really big emphasis. Obviously, recovery in football is a massive topic.
Yeah. Then during and after, do you have any influence at all, even to the extent of knowledge about what's happening with those players? Or are you waiting to receive them back at the end of their involvement in the World Cup and then react to their physical condition, their fatigue, their recovery status? Or do you have maybe even with the national team, but not other teams that your players play for? How does it work communication and activation wise?
Sure, yeah. So it depends on the federation, to be honest. So with the federation, we usually get really, really good feedback. Like we're all here to try and do the same thing, really, and that's get the best out of the players. So I think we certainly come from an angle of let's work together on this because we want the best for the player. Nobody wants the player to get injured, whether it's the federation or the club. So we try and work together as much as we possibly can. Obviously, we're going to get data and we get feedback from the federation around what they've done. And we try and keep open communications there. Equally, a set of numbers or a set of data can only tell you so much in terms of the context from what that player's come, what they've been feeling, their emotional response to the tournament, around whether they've had individual success and team success as well. And obviously, I think one of the challenges really around players that go away on international with an international, you're never really going to have a training stimulus, or you never get the chance to have a training stimulus that sits in that kind of what I would call that adaptation bucket, where you, where you're trying to overload them to create an adaptive response, because your fixtures come so thick and fast. And I think one of the challenges is with the players that sit on the fringe of the squad.
Yeah.
The ones that don't necessarily play so much, but equally the ones they're not training so much as well.
Yeah.
And that's a real, they're the ones that are probably more of a challenge to manage when you come back, because they've probably been underloaded or underconditioned over a period of time. The boys and the girls that come back that have played some quite good game time, the reality is, because there's so many games, you get quite a lot of your adaptive and conditioning response from the game.
Mm.
So they're actually not too bad, because they're obviously, they're playing against good teams. They're getting really good competition level. So they're getting a really good stimulus. So I'd say, I'd argue that they're maybe, can sometimes be less of a factor, because they can actually get back into the club and hit the ground running again.
Mm. I suppose that's also juxtapositioned against the fact that those the best players in the squad are going to be playing more regularly. Therefore, they're probably more likely to get fatigued and potentially suffer from chronic or injuries. How do you, I mean, when you look at that sort of scenario, take us through the recovery methods that you use, particularly on those players that are participating a lot in those weekly games or bi-weekly games.
I mean, just as context to that, like in the peak of the season when you're in the Champions League, players will play typically, I don't know, Portugal, but it'll be Saturday and then a Wednesday, then a Sunday and a Thursday. So every couple of weeks, four matches. That's the recovery that you've got to now optimize. What's in your toolbox?
Yeah, it's tough. And so in the toolbox, what you'll be looking for is you'll be looking for some individual knowledge on the player. And I think this is really probably underestimated now with the amount of data that's gone on. So, you know, if you think about a person's response to a stimulus, there's multiple things that are going to affect it. And you know, there's going to be genetic predisposition, there's going to be personal predispositions and traits, you know, their stress history and resilience, their prior training and injury history, and then their current, like their acute stress status as well. So I think one of the key things, and I think that some of the clubs that are more successful have this, is having staff and people that really know the players. And by that, I mean, you know, you guys will have worked with athletes before, and especially in Olympic sports, you get this culture of where coaches and support staff spend a lot of time and have been with athletes for a long time. So they have that performance, like, structure wrapped around them for quite a long time, and you intimately get to know the athlete and how they respond, what works well for them, what works doesn't. And I think the more you can have that within a club, the better. Then off the back of that, going into some more technical sports science stuff, we'll look to do some post-match monitoring. Obviously we go for the big rocks first. You've got to go for the big rocks first in terms of nutrition and sleep. And really try and optimize those as much as we can for each individual. And this is also a challenge for some clubs as well, because it's based on the resources that you have. So it's not like an Olympic sport. One of my observations coming from Olympic sport is the coach to athlete ratio is much smaller than it traditionally has been in a team sport. So if you think of, you've got a squad of say 22 to 25 players, you know, how can you, and the bigger clubs are resourcing it now where you're really reducing that coach to athlete ratio or support practitioner to athlete ratio, so you can get that more intimate knowledge. But yeah, then going into your monitoring, so we would take some blood markers, we would do some subjective monitoring as well, and then we would try and do some sleep monitoring in and around the games as well.
Daily,
to understand how they're responding. No, it's immediately pre, and we'll do a variation of some of those variables pre and post game. Yeah.
Mm. I'm quite interested. I mean, you talked around the philosophy behind it, but just give us a sort of an idea of what actually happens. So the guys play a game, Take us through the routine. You talked about monitoring sleep, but what actually happens to, as they come off the field, what happens immediately post match and then maybe for the 2-3 days after that to encourage that recovery?
Yeah, so they'll be straight, they would be straight into the changing room. They go straight into some form of recovery strategy, probably nutritionally. They'd be straight into that. If you have the resources to take them with you, which some clubs do and some clubs don't, you know, maybe into some sort of water immersion in the changing rooms, which can be done. And then we'll go straight into probably some compression garments, which is, you know, a relatively low risk proposition, even though the research, you know, isn't quite in agreement on it. But and then yeah, depending on the home and away fixtures as well, operationally will depend on what you're doing. So I know sometimes we might look to stay on another night, you know, especially if you're traveling away and you're abroad, like in a Champions League fixture. So we can get straight out of the stadium, straight into the hotel and into a sleep pattern. And then over the next 24 hours, we'll start to take those blood markers, try and highlight any anomalies that flag up for any of the players. Again, constantly looking at what the fixture congestion looks like as well for those players. So, for example, the cumulative load over time, taking that into consideration and making sure we're having those conversations as well. And then they come in the day after, we'd look at those markers, and then maybe go through some additional recovery strategies, whether that's some more water immersion and active recovery as well. And then try and control their nutrition for the majority part of that day. And then equally, you're going to have some players that need a training stimulus that haven't maybe had a stimulus from the game. So you tend to split in. And different coaches have different philosophies on this. You know, some would like the day after the game completely off, so you don't have to come into the club. From a psychological perspective, especially if you've got a high percentage of players, for example, that have families, you know, reducing that time away from the family. And some coaches like to bring the players in on match day plus one, almost use that as a bit of a reset day, and sometimes have match day plus two. So you almost get the whole squad back onto the same schedule again. So that when you come back in after match day plus two, everybody's kind of in the same place, so you can move on. Because you do have team demands as well, as much as it's obviously really important to individualise. You know, it's a team sport and you have to function as a team.
What's interesting is that I wonder how scientific it is, and you'll be able to answer this, I'm sure. Do you measure how many minutes of game time a player will have and then say, look, this player's had X amount of game time, therefore there needs to be more rest for the next 2 weeks and this player can play more? I mean, is it as scientific as that in terms of measuring game time?
I think we probably go a little bit deeper than that as well, and most clubs probably will as well, in terms of actually looking at what their load is like during the game. So it can be quite, time can be quite a blunt tool, obviously, because it depends on the opposition. So it's one of the phenomenons of the sport, right? It's like sometimes your physical output is completely dependent on what the opposition look like and what type of game it is. But, you know, you can go, we have live monitoring now of GPS or physical metrics, for example. So we can actually look at what their game outputs are like relative to their normal, their maximum, their minimum, for example. So all 45 minutes are never equal.
Yeah.
So using 45 minutes as an example can be quite blunt, although I would say it's still a useful consideration as well.
I was just going to say, so the load metrics you use then would be specifically meters of high intensity running, sprint meters, stuff like that, right?
Does
it even get more granular than that? Like, would you measure jumps made, directional changes, hard accelerations? Because as you know, like a 5 meter acceleration, maybe 10 meter acceleration doesn't get you into high speed running, but it's actually very physiologically demanding. So what level of microscopic detail do you go into then, and let me ask that and then I'll follow it up with the next one.
For that I'd say we do take consideration of all of those things. Jumps, I'd say we don't have the capacity to do that now or yet. We do in the indoor sports where we have a positioning system which can measure that. Obviously, you can't use GPS indoors. And that actually becomes really important when you're talking about a sport like volleyball as well, which where they don't run, but they jump a lot. But we would look at all those things in terms of, I would say, if you want to term it like gait response. So like with a high speed running, sprinting zones, but then also look at more mechanical responses in terms of those change of directions, the heavy accelerations, the decelerations. Obviously, the research has shown that decelerations obviously have a massive damaging effect. Of course, it's basically an eccentric action, right? Overload, especially how incredibly well some of them change direction as well. And then we can use some stuff off of our specific GPS provider as well, in terms of where they've created some algorithms around high intensity moments. And then the other one is to also look at the intensity of the game relative to the time. So it's not just about looking at the absolute score. It's about looking at the absolute score relative to the time, because, you know, you and I can achieve however much high speed running, but, you know, one of us might do it in 10 minutes and one of us might do it in 40 minutes. So the density is different.
What, in your experience, is the best metric to judge load against?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Oh. I mean, it's
yeah, you already know the answer to that one, because there's probably no one thing. There is no one.
Yeah, there's no. No, you're right. There's no one. But I mean, like, if you had to make a snap judgment, the coach says, Nick, I need to pick a squad. I need to know between these two players, is what would you go to first? Instinct or data?
Instinct.
So that's that acquired knowledge that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. But that instinct is going to, that instinct is going to be based on objective and subjective measures.
Right. That's so learned over time. Yeah.
That you have to learn. And you've also got to try and learn the player as well. That instinct isn't completely subjective at all. One of the challenges with the amount of data that's now being produced in every area, in not just physical, is it's really useful. But the reality of what is really useful is the ability to interpret it and translate it into meaningful action. So it is really useful having a page of numbers, but it's probably more interesting than useful. What's useful is the interpretation of that data and translating it into some meaningful action for the player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But just wanted to, actually, sorry, Mike, you go on.
Yeah, I mean, I always think, and I think this applies to most sports, is that you obviously get situations where players are eager to play and they will defy or even potentially lie to the person that's with them so they can continue to play the game. How do you, is that a consideration in football where players push themselves beyond what they're capable of and you guys need to intervene? And how good is that communication between sports scientists that are working with the players and the players themselves?
Yeah, it's a good question. Players will always want to play, and it always amazes me sometimes how they can play when you genuinely think they can't as well. I even had that in rugby, and I'm sure you guys have seen it. You know, we've had some players that, you know, during the week of training, you're thinking, oh God, they don't train. But then somehow on match day, they turn out and have an absolute worldie. You know, where did that come from? Which is just amazing. So I think it's constantly challenging you around what you know or what you think you know. And, you know, the whole philosophy of let's predict injuries. Like, the reality is there's just too many variables. It's like the old graphic equalizer. There's so many variables, you just can't pick out one to hang your hat on. So, yeah, I think with a player, from a player perspective, if you come at it from a from an angle of trust and we're here to support you and do the best thing for you as well as for the team, I genuinely would say 99.9% of players will understand that and be on board with that. And you can't punish them for being ambitious and wanting to play and try and realize their potential.
Mm.
But equally, sometimes they have to go off your intuition, your knowledge, combined with their knowledge of their body, because a lot of the time that's going to be way better. They're going to know their body better than me, probably most of the time, and then try and find that solution together. And then you start delving into the realms of like the practitioner and coach athlete relationship there, which is going to determine those levels of influence, those levels of conversations that you can have.
Mm. I mean, it probably wouldn't surprise listeners to know that the subjective report from the player is the best predictor of an imminent injury.
Mm.
I mean, that's the case. Would you agree, Nick? I mean, it's the subjective. I don't feel right. I'm excessively tired. My muscles are sore. That predicts injury. In fact, there's a paper came out relatively recently. There's a journal called the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance, and they have a special issue with a focus on football in conjunction with the World Cup. Came out literally in September. One of the papers that made the cut is called Recovery During a Congested Schedule and Injury in Professional Football. And they monitor a whole bunch of stuff, like Nick said, graphic equalizer time. And the best predictor is non-contact injury. So that's like a hamstring strain. It's a tendinopathy. It's like the kind of chronic overload injury associated with fatigue and muscle soreness in the 2 and 3 days after matches. And increase, and this goes back to recovery, an increase of sleep quantity during the 2 nights following a match is associated with lower risk of injury and a lower reduction in muscle force production. So you get fatigue, but less fatigue when you sleep better. Mm. That's not rocket science. You don't need a paper to know this. But the point is that what the athlete reports is actually maybe your loudest canary.
And is there a self-assessment protocol that you have with the athletes? In other words, do you give them a form or an app at the beginning of the day and say, you know, tell us how you're feeling today. Give us your self-assessment.
Yeah, it's worked different in different clubs that I've had experience of. Sometimes they use a form. Sometimes it's actually a face-to-face conversation, but a structured conversation. So that you're trying to standardize the conversation and standardize the response as well, so that you can maybe score it yourself. And then I think the key there is what's normal for that player over time and establishing anything that's out of that normal. And there's always going to be stuff that you can't measure as well that you have to take into consideration. So, for example, family bereavement, anything at home around maybe relationships, the stress of somebody coming into a contract negotiation, for example. You know, those things have to be considered as an added layer on top as well and just brought into the conversation. They're not necessarily going to determine, that one thing is not necessarily going to determine what you do, but it's something you put on the table to consider.
Yeah, it's funny how we always, every time we talk to him about sports science and sport, we end up on relational elements. And actually, you know, like, I don't know if you found this, Nick, but in my time with the South African Sevens, the most important person in the ecosystem was the physio, because he would be giving the players rub downs or strapping and so on. And then they would confide in him in a moment of relaxation that they were going through some relationship issue. Their father was sick, or they were worried about finances. They had a loan there to pay or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was in a very privileged but important position, because it would be up to him to say, you know, that player's underperforming because of emotional things that you blokes, you science types, are missing.
Yeah.
But if he violated the trust, he'd no longer have that position. So it's a difficult situation. You need good people, not good scientists.
Yeah. Would you concur with that, Chad?
Yeah. I definitely concur with that. And I think if you can get really good people that obviously have a knowledge and are able to interpret the data, because the reality is, you know, if you do something radical outside of the norm, like any of us go away today and do something physically radical or different to what we're normally used to, we're going to know about it tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
So the reality is, you've got to stay within a threshold, within a bandwidth from a physical and a numbers perspective of training load. But then equally outside of that, there's a lot more information, because that one of my favorite phrases is that not all that counts can be counted. Mm. And that's so true. You've got so many variables in the pot.
Listen, I wanted to circle back to something you said a little earlier. You spoke about in recovery, you go for the big rocks first, the sleep and nutrition, which I agree with. Does it ever, and you've been in so many sports now, so you'll see this is a universal human trait, is the desire to just throw everything at the problem. So we know recovery makes a difference. Therefore, let's do everything. And you even alluded to the fact that compression garments, there's not much evidence for, but it's low risk. In your sports science experience, where is football on the spectrum of gimmicky, gadgetry thinking compared to some of the others? And how do you as a scientist juggle foundational stuff against innovative things you know probably don't really work?
Yeah, okay. So there was actually a really great summary paper. I think it was back in 2017 by Kelman around recovery strategies and around some of the things that are out there to support it. And obviously some have higher levels of evidence than others that are published and some that are not. And I think it was 2018, Kelman, sorry. And I think the things that they highlighted in that paper was individualized strategies, which I touched on a bit, appropriate physiological mechanisms. So, you know, when we obviously mentioned the big rocks, it's like, well, okay, when we're going for those physiological mechanisms, that, you know, let's make sure we get the ones that we definitely know work. It talks about the periodization or organizing the interventions, and then positive player perception and quality above quantity. So it's funny what you just said around, you know, you want to throw the kitchen sink at it. I think you can throw the kitchen sink at it if you do it in a clever way. I think you can certainly use strategies that might be more termed more like marginal gains or one percenters. But I would say you've got to get the big rocks right first, like we spoke about, because those one percenters will have a bigger impact if you've got the rest right. And then it's about getting the player perception on board. And again, it's coming from a subjective anecdotal thing, but you'll find that some recovery strategies actually cause more harm than good in terms of the way it makes a player feel. Cold water immersion was always one that was a challenge, you know, that some players felt like they responded really well from it, and others you could just see it was an absolute stressor, to the point where they were probably thinking in the last 2 minutes of the game, oh crap, I've got to get in an ice bath after this, which is kind of doing the opposite of what you're trying to achieve. I think the positive player perception is a massive thing, and giving them a bit of empowerment. Like it's clearly been shown that if a player feels empowered and engaged in a process, that actually that will have a positive impact on how they respond to it. And you know, even if it is a placebo in inverted commas, does it actually matter if it's having a positive effect at the back end? I would argue no, because ultimately your underlying objective is to optimize that recovery strategy and fundamentally performance in the preceding training or competition.
Yeah.
Nick, tell us about the injuries that these players suffer from most. I mean, what is the most common football injury?
Yeah, it's to the thigh. The most common football injury, if you look at the UEFA Champions League studies, the most common injury is to the thigh in football, as an area specifically. I don't have all the answers as to why, but because obviously there's so many variables and there's so many different mechanisms. There's obviously been a lot of research and study and a trend towards the impact of how high speed running, not in terms of the threshold, but as in literally running fast, has an impact on that. But equally, we see what fascinates me is we see a lot of other sports and a lot of other athletes that run really, really fast as well and might have a lesser injury incidence. So I think it's probably a combination of factors, including for things like the competition schedule, the fact that they have to change direction, which I think is, you know, massively, well, it's obviously respected within the sport, but outside of sport, when you see these athletes change direction, it's really, really impressive. That was my first observation coming from rugby, coming into football, seeing how quickly the guys changed direction was incredible.
Yeah.
And then going back to watch rugby, obviously there's a lot of human being that they have to change direction in terms of mass. And they do that really, really differently in terms of their strategies to do it.
Mm.
I always love the debate where they talk about who are the fittest sports people in the world, and, you know, of all across the sports. I mean, having worked in various sports, let me throw that question at you. Do you think football players are the fittest sports people, if you look at it overall? Ability, endurance, all those sort of things.
That's even worse than my question.
That's way worse than your question.
I like to throw the odd one.
Yeah, yeah. They're the fittest at playing football. Yeah. But then, you know, you try any sport. You know, when I was working with the pole vault guys, you know, I consider myself a reasonably fit human being. And I had to go at a pole vault session. It took me a good 3 days to get over that.
Yeah.
You know, the velocity that they throw themselves into that contact with the pole, you know, is like incredible. Like, and the amount of strength they need and the speed that they approach it is amazing. I think every sport is amazing. You know, you get a rugby player to try to play football, which we did in some warm-ups. It's interesting to watch. and you get a football player to try and play rugby or do pole vault. It's completely different. So I think they deserve respect in their own right, as opposed to trying to be compared across sports.
Yeah.
There's a good segue maybe to talk a little bit about the physiological demands and what you're actually conditioning a player for. And in that context, our listeners will watch World Cup matches. And I don't know what it's like where you are, or England, or wherever anyone's listening to this. But here in South Africa, they'll show some stats at halftime. They'll show you a stat for total distance run by the team, which is one of the least meaningful stats you'll ever see in any sport ever. Because presumably it includes the goalkeeper. It's completely meaningless. And then when a player comes off, I was watching Spain, Germany last night, and at 50 minutes, someone came off and they'll say distance run, 5.5 kilometers, passes completed, and so on. And they'll give you these little tidbits of stats. But let's give people proper insight and explain what are you actually conditioning a footballer to do?
Sure. So essentially, it's a repeated high-intensity sport, right? So you do have positional variations. But the biggest positional variation is the goalkeeper compared to the outfield players. And depending on the way you play for the out, if we just talk about the outfield players will have different physical outputs, obviously, depending on position. So like a centre-back will have a very different physical output compared to a winger.
Mm.
But essentially, they're all taking part in high-intensity and repeated high-intensity actions. What those actions actually are, so if you have a player, say, in central midfield, for example, it's quite clearly been shown that they tend to have much more changes of direction as their high-intensity efforts than, say, a wide player that will have it more in a running fast type high-intensity action, yeah, or repeated sprints. But the one thing that's common is they're all running and they're all changing direction, high intensity. And the thing that generally defines, and what you said about the meaningless stat about the total distance, is the thing that generally defines the more successful teams than the non-successful teams is that they output more high intensity efforts than the non-successful teams, in my experience and of everything I've seen.
I've seen similar studies. I remember looking into this, and the difference between elite and good is not total. It's a sharp end of the spear, as it were. You know, how many sprints do you do? How much time or distance do you cover or rate at sprint speed? So that's what you're saying there, right, Nick? It's
exactly. So you could argue that high speed running as a statistic from the GPS is kind of actually a mid-zone. It's not really that high speed, especially for some of the players that we're and the athletes we're talking about nowadays that can run as fast as they can.
Right. Let's give people an idea of that. So like in the papers I've seen, like 20 to 25K an hour is called high speed running. And that's not that fast. That's like a marathon runner runs.
So we're depends, actually, depends how fast you are though, doesn't
depends
it?
Who the marathon runner is. But I'm thinking Kipchoge now, 21K an hour marathon, right? So yeah. What sort of speed zones are you looking at then?
So we would class that as our high speed running zone. Then you're looking at a sprint zone that you'd look at roughly, depending on which provider you use and which club it is, roughly around above 25 kilometers an hour. And then we're obviously looking at maximum speed outputs. We know what the player's maximum speeds are and where they're achieving, how many times they might achieve a percentage above 85%, for example, of the maximum speed.
Yeah. I mean, how do you deal with the reality that when you talk about speed, you're actually talking about an end point of an action. And if I'm watching a game and I'm watching England play against Wales now tomorrow, I think it is, as we were sitting record, Harry Kane's at the top of the box on the D and he's going to sprint to the penalty spot. He's got no chance of making top speed, but that sprint is potentially extremely demanding and crucial to the outcome of the game. So how do you measure that? Where does that get factored in?
So then we have the ability to measure, you know, something from the GPS, accelerations and decelerations.
Okay.
And we tend to do that above a certain meters per second squared. And some clubs will use two factors in there. Some clubs might just use one threshold in there, but that would fall into that category. So they would register an acceleration into that. And a deceleration, like we spoke about before, is probably even more interesting when it comes to the damage that occurs from that stimulus.
So that's
again a massive consideration, and you know that's what we're saying. The players that sit, for example, a midfielder that sits in the middle there, will register a lot more of those actions than they would say entries and time spent in a high speed running or a sprint distance zone.
Yeah, whereas your fullback is often making that overlapping run and covering 50 meters and will hit 30K an hour regularly.
Yeah. Absolutely. And they're conditioned to do that. So then when you're going to compare data, you know, you've got to make sure you're not comparing apples and pears. So, you know, if you're looking at those wide players, what they're producing is obviously going to be significantly higher than players based in the middle of the field in terms of gait, in terms of that sprinting. So, but they're conditioned to that. You know, they're conditioned to that. So that might be normal for them, whereas the same statistics might be a complete overload for a different position, or not a complete overload, but an overreach. You know, they would have had to overreach significantly to achieve that. Coming to the interpretation of the data and knowing the sport and the players.
So do different positions in the sport change their way they train as well as a result of that? Do they have different training regimes?
Yeah, so that we obviously train mostly as a team, and as a team you'll train in a position specific way because you are training for the game. I think I only like I said before we started the podcast that, you know, my experience is I don't know all football. I can only speak from my experiences that I've had, but you know, really good coaches, I think, train the game specifically. There was a big trend towards, you know, small-sided games and a big push towards that. And I think from observing different coaches' work, they really make it specific to the sizes that need to be played. So, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon to go and see an 11v11. And that makes logical sense, right? You've got to train for the competition the same way endurance sports or an Olympic sport, you would touch on what you would call race pace. That you might do a bit of training at a race pace, you know? And the same as that would be football's race pace, you know, is doing some 11v11 or 10v10 on a full pitch.
So I'm maybe a question following on from that is, are there sort of some baseline numbers that you can run on players? So you've obviously worked not only with the elites, but you've obviously looked at grassroots level as well. Can you look at a player who's, you know, up and coming and say, right, do a series of tests and this is their sprint speed, this is their this is the capacity they have to run through a series of hurdles, et cetera, and you can establish via the numbers whether they are capable of being at that at a certain level in the sport.
So, yeah, this is an interesting one. So testing is quite probably a relatively controversial and challenging subject in football, partly around the because the competition schedule makes it challenging. But what I would say, physical capacity is probably not going to win you the game outright. But it will lose it for you if you haven't got it.
Yeah.
So what you need to have is you need to have a sufficient physical capacity, yeah, to be able to tolerate the demands of the game, to be able to as well play the way that the coach wants to play, and execute the tactical and technical skills that you need to essentially try and get success. But as a standalone variable, it's not going to win it for you.
Mm. Mm.
And this is one of the challenging but also fascinating things about the sport, is that there are so many variables as in to what controls success. And so much of the actual game is random. Trying to really just pinpoint one thing and go, you can be really good at this, so you will have a really good game, or you will be really good, just isn't sufficient. And you have to look at the whole spectrum. And that is one of the, yeah, it's one of the great performance pieces of the sport, is that you are trying to combine all those things to look at what success is. And there's also no one right or wrong way to play the game. I'm not a coach, so I can't talk for coaches, but there's no one right or wrong way to play the game. When you look at the different philosophies, different styles, different tactics that coaches want to play, they don't all do it the same way. But they might get a really similar result at the end of the season, as in the two teams finish, what, a point off to win the league, but they've done it in a really different way. Mm. I think that's also fascinating.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. The interesting thing is there's so many ways to win and lose that there's no one metric. Again, you know, we're trying to be reductionist here, but actually it doesn't fit. But
I almost look at it in terms of, you look at a cyclist and you say, well, if a cyclist isn't doing 5.5 watts a kilo as an 18-year-old, he's never going to be in with a chance of being a professional cyclist.
Right.
Whereas what you're saying is the variables in soccer are far wider than that.
Well, just compare Messi and Ronaldo physically.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to score goals in very different ways, but they're both going to score 40 or whatever it is a year for a decade. So, so which one would you then pick? Or maybe put that aside, because that one causes, take Drogba compared to, pick a striker from one of the teams that doesn't score goals the way that he used to, you know? Very different ways to score and win.
Yeah, and so they have different attributes. So again, right. it's like that graphic equalizer sort of comparison. It's like you can use it not just for training, but you can use it also to profile a player. Like players or athletes are going to have strengths in different areas. You know, you could have a player that's technically and tactically very, very good, but physically not so good. So, you know what you need to work on, but actually, that the technical and the tactical ability allow them still to compete at a very, very high level.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then you think, right, where's the opportunity here? So you maintain the super strengths. Like, we always talk about the areas of weakness and what we need to develop, but actually keep investing in those super strengths as well, because really that's what got them there and what keeps them there as well. And you're going to have that over so many different variables when you break... I mean, you break technical and you break tactical down, and then you just have a load of variables cascading out the bottom of that. And, you know, you can be really good in certain areas and not so good in other areas.
Yeah. Better example, Erling Haaland and Mo Salah. You know, neither at the World Cup, strikers for the two, best teams in England, theoretically. Completely different skill sets, physical attributes and so on. So it's quite interesting like that. And in that context, when you watch a World Cup and you see different playing styles, what you were talking about earlier, Nick, the demands of the game. I mean, when a team plays against, say, Morocco, I watched them beat Belgium yesterday, as opposed to Spain, the physical demands of playing against different opposition must be totally different also.
Yeah.
So it doesn't Yes. Doesn't that create situations where actually physical conditioning does become the thing that wins you the game?
It will contribute.
Yeah.
But sometimes you will also have to pick players based on what they offer you from a physical perspective. Like, managers will pick players based on what they offer on a physical perspective, aligned to how they want to play. I'm talking about it at a very simple level, like especially from a coach's perspective. But, you know, if you are going to want to press really aggressively for 90 minutes, so every time you lose the ball, you want the ball back within 6 seconds, you know, you're going to have to choose players that can do that. Especially if you're not going to have the ball for 90% of the game, that's going to be hard work.
Yeah.
So you've really got to have players that have the capacity to do that. So, you know, that comes into it as well. And you start to bring in the art as well. But then to try and live out of the grey zones a little bit, we do try and measure things and profile players based on where their strengths and super strengths and areas of development are, right? So, you know, we know roughly what a player's good at and what they need to develop. And therefore, you can try and make an informed decision based around that. And more importantly, you can actually guide the training process and the training interventions around those as well to try and individualize them and improve them in those areas or maintain their ability in those super strength areas.
Has the game evolved in the, I suppose maybe this is unfair because you haven't been involved in it for generations, but if I look back at even the 2010 World Cup that was won here in South Africa by Spain, and then that was coincident with the period of Guardiola's peak at Barcelona, and obviously now you see it at Man City, and this there seems to have been an evolution in the way the game is played.
Yeah,
and that must have significant implications for your job. So when the coach says, "I want to press and I want to implement the 6 second ball retrieval strategy," what are you going to focus on in the off season if that wasn't the plan before?
Yeah, so that will change. Well, for starters, it will actually change team training, what team training looks like, because you'll start to train in that way. If a coach comes in to do that, there's another factor you've got to balance here, and that is then the injury risk that comes from doing something completely different. Like if you change in philosophy or doing something completely different. So if we change our training philosophy tomorrow morning and start doing something completely different than what we've been doing, our body's going to have a significant reaction to that. That it's because we're doing something we're not used to. So, and there's research out there that shows that, you know, that the injury burden increases significantly in the 2 weeks and the month post a manager change, because they bring in a new philosophy, a new way of doing things. And therefore, that usually is associated with a different type of training load. So what I would say is the first thing you've got to do is you've got to see where the end goal is and try and, you know, almost reverse engineer it, which isn't uncommon in like a cycling event, is it? You know, you kind of have a target on what a time is, for example, for a time trial, when you reverse engineer what you need to try and get there. And I would say that's the one thing you've got to do when you get maybe a new coach that brings in a new philosophy, is you're not going to get there immediately. And you've just got to balance that act of like that constant pushing the players, but knowing when not to push to support them. Because at the end of the day, availability is highly linked to success of clubs as well. So a team is not going to be successful if they don't have their best players available to play. So you then have to balance that variable as well. So yes, we want to push and we want to get to this goal of being this team that presses for 90 minutes, gets the ball back within 6 seconds, as the example that you mentioned and we mentioned. But it's like, right, how are we going to get there and how long are we going to take to get there to push it without making sure we don't have an availability that's going to be really detrimental? Because the reality is the off-season and the pre-season aren't that long. It's not long before you start getting straight back into a competitive fixture schedule, and you don't want to be entering that with, you know, a quarter of the squad unavailable.
My final question is, looking forward in terms of You know, we've seen in rugby, for instance, things like, you know, mouth guards with systems in them and all that sort of thing. What do you see in terms of sports science and soccer maybe 10 years down the road? And where do you think football can go as opposed to where it is now? You know, there's obviously certain ways of doing things. Where do you think it can improve, and where do you think technology can make football better for the players and maybe potentially better for the spectators?
Yeah. Ooh, okay.
Let's just focus on the players, shall we?
Yeah, the first bit. Yeah, the first bit around where it's going. That's a great question. I haven't got a crystal ball, and obviously we've got, you know, we're working with youth development as well. So we're not actually preparing these players for what football is today. We're preparing them for what football is in 5 to 10 years, and like the reality is, we don't actually know what that will look like, because if you went 10 years back and said, oh, this is what football's going to look like in 2022, I'm pretty sure there wouldn't be many people that would say it was necessarily going to be that way. So that's a challenge. But what we're trying to do is give, especially development players, well-rounded skill sets around in every area, well-rounded skill sets, and then equally knowledge. Touching on what we spoke a little bit about earlier around knowledge of their own body and their own strategies to help manage themselves as well. So I think one of the negative sides of having so much resource and maybe so much having so much money available is that sometimes quite a lot can get done for the players. And, you know, that's on the proviso that we're giving more resource, we're giving more support so that they don't have to do as much, which essentially means they can increase their performance levels in training and playing to squeeze more out of themselves. But I'm not sure that works, because to get more out of yourself, I'd argue you probably need to know yourself really, really well and not rely on somebody else to do that. So then it's like bringing in that education with the young players now, where they do know themselves, because the reality is in football and the culture of football that there will be change, there will be flux, they will change clubs, they will change philosophies, they will change support practitioners. But if they can enter a scenario and know what they need to do and keep the continuity of their training, then that's a really positive thing. I think it's really interesting to talk about the other 23 hours. So not the 2 hours that they're training, but the other 23 hours around it, and how we can probably manage that well. That's always a balance around, you know, you're obviously intruding into athletes' lives. So if you go through the amount of monitoring that's done with some of the athletes, you know, it is relative, it's very intrusive if you're tracking them all the time, especially with the ability of wearables now to wear them 24 hours a day. And then, like I touched on earlier, I think the really, from in my experience of speaking and seeing coaches, are really good coaches are really individually making players better. So that notion of, are we going to buy a player and get a transfer of a player into a club and they're kind of like ready made and we don't need to do anything, we can just helicopter and drop them in. I think really good coaches are really reducing that coach to athlete ratio, and really investing on the development of the individual whilst maintaining the team philosophy and team culture to move forward. I think that's where people are going to have a lot of success.
A couple of questions from me back to Qatar. Have you noticed anything, or do you know anything from on the ground that you might have heard about the effect of heat on performance? It hasn't been, obviously, because of the window they're playing in, nearly as bad as it would have been in June, July. But I did see reports that it's been in the low 30s and that players are coming out of European time November. Have you heard anything about that?
No, to be honest. There's not been a lot around that. And the indoor air conditioning's helped a little bit as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, I did wonder whether, I think I saw a stat, well, I heard a stat in commentary saying that in the first 25 games, 13 had reached 0-0 at halftime. And then they open up big time in the second half. And it's always interested me because there's two things happen. One is fatigue. It's all of a sudden, because the ball, you see, the ball doesn't get tired. And so it moves into spaces at the same speed the whole game long, maybe a little bit slow because they get typed in passing, but the players do. And so towards the end of a game, they drop off. I did see a paper where it said that only 3% of players will do their highest 5 minutes of activity in the last 15 minutes, whereas 40% do their lowest. So the players are much slower at the end of the game. That's why subs open the game up and you get more chances and so on. I did wonder whether the Heat had something to do with the excessively, and I'm projecting here, conservative start to matches.
Yeah, it could be. I haven't heard anything. Maybe the teams are really evenly matched. and then towards the back end of the game, like you said, you know, to execute technically and tactically under fatigue is a challenge. It's tough. It's tough. Mm. And there's mistakes are going to happen. The game's going to come more open as people just can't get to the same space in the same amount of time or can't execute the same technical skill at the same speed they could in the first 15 minutes, first half an hour.
And then last question, just on some players, like, as an S&C person now watching it through that lens, who are some of the players who strike you as the most impressive? And I know there are different skill sets for different players, and so we can't compare the center back to the fullback and the center forward and the midfielder. But when you're watching this World Cup, who do you look at and go, that is some kind of physical specimen? For their purpose?
If I'm honest, I probably haven't seen enough of all of the games to really pull one player out. I've watched the England and USA game the other day. The interpretation of the result for some, but what I really enjoyed watching was just how the intensity of the game. The intensity of the game is brilliant to see all the way through the game, and it's also been really good to see some upsets as well, which I think is great because it goes against everything that we think we know again as well. So on paper, you know, you look at a team and you think what the result is. And I think that's what makes the performance challenge so much more interesting, is that we don't know, because it would be really boring if we did know, wouldn't it? But in terms of like individual players, I'm probably not best placed to actually pick any out right now. I just pick all the English players out probably.
Yeah, I always find from a non sort of soccer football fan perspective that it's the one sport that seems to always bring up the odd surprise. You know, the form book doesn't necessarily always seem to work in football, whereas most sports you can predict, you know, normally you can predict a result fairly well, but in football it seems to vary a lot, which I guess is what makes it exciting, why people are so drawn to the sport itself. So
Like one of the differences in rugby, if you're physically dominant, you're not losing more than 1 in 100 matches, you know. If you have parity, other things start to matter. But in football, you can actually have you can actually not have parity in one domain, but achieve it in another domain and then potentially be superior in that domain. So Nick said it earlier, there's so many ways to win.
Yeah.
Plus, one goal decides the game.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched Costa Rica, Japan, and they had, I reckon, one shot and target. They beat them 1-0.
Yeah.
Exactly that. You can dominate the game. You can have the most shots on target by a long way and you can still lose.
Yeah.
So when you said you watched the US England match and you just appreciated the intensity, are you talking, what do you think it is? I'm always interested in the mind of people who look at it with different perspectives. What is it that tells you this is intense?
So when I look at it, and obviously England probably went in as favourites to win that game, and I think they probably didn't have the success that they wanted to have in that game in terms of winning it. But yet to see players still when they're out of possession, and to see the ebb and flow of the game as well. So the first part of the game, England were probably more dominant, and then the USA came back into it, and the game ebbs and flows like all games do. But to see the way that the players were just continuously aggressively pressing, aggressively trying to get the ball back, working hard for their teammates, you know, again, seeing, you know, like Harry Kane, you mentioned Harry Kane earlier, just some of the positions that he was coming up in, it was like, wow, did he get from there to there so quickly? And I just really, really appreciating, you know, when you see good athletes in any sport and you've watched the sport for a bit, you just really appreciate what they're doing. I think the one thing that you don't get on TV, which you do get when it's live, and especially when you're around training sessions when there's no fans, is you probably don't appreciate actually the stuff that can't be measured, and that's like the contacts. Like, obviously it's nothing like rugby where you're running head on into someone, but you know, the contacts that the players make and the physical duels are not insignificant. And you know, sometimes you need to be there live to hear that as well. And that's maybe an area in the future that might be something that could be better measured, and around the demands of those, because it's like the conundrum we had in rugby. You know, when you do a live scrum, for example, practice session, you know, all the numbers are coming back as zeros. Yeah. Off your GPS. Yeah. But you look at the players and it's definitely not a zero session, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The reason I asked is, I'll sometimes be watching a game and a commentator will say that, you know, team X looks really flat today.
Yeah.
I don't understand what he means. I don't know what he's looking at when he says that, because it might be that tactically they're not trying to win the ball back aggressively, and that's the only thing he's looking at. And so I'm always interested at how people can judge whether a team looks like they're intense or not, and what the best metric is to say that was an intense game. You know, I mean, the data point from rugby is I forget which World Cup it was, but Australia once beat Uruguay like 150-something nil or 3, like a complete like annihilation. That was the most that those players ran in any match in about 5 years, the Australian players. And they came off the field absolutely exhausted.
Yeah.
But it was an easy game, right? But hang on, it wasn't. And so I'm always interested, like, what am I not seeing when someone says they look flat or it's intense? It's always curious to me.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the time, those the finals, you know, in the World Cup now, when we get to the knockout, they will often be very boring matches to watch. But the players on the field are at the very limit. It's not slow. It looks like it is, though. Why?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I don't know.
that's an interesting point. You know, like, what, are they playing every 4 days? You know, the density of the games. Like, to them, you know, when you're in a game, I think partly as well, the thing that I highlighted was the mentality of that, because they're quite clearly in a game where they've not had success. They've not necessarily had a lot of goal scoring opportunities in the final third, but yet still they're working incredibly hard. It's easy to get, you know, from a mental perspective, it's easy to get despondent with that. But yet still they're putting it on the line. They're putting their body on the line to try and win that ball back and stay in the game and win it. And the example you just gave of rugby, we had a similar example pre-season game, and scored a hell of a lot, and the boys come off the pitch and they're absolutely exhausted.
Nick Chad, it's been a fascinating discussion. I can tell you, I thought I'd learn at least double what I knew about soccer, and I keep on calling it soccer, but I've learned more about football in the last hour than I've known before, so thank you very much for that. And I think what's great is that you have this unique perspective, having had worked with other sports as well, so you understand that there are different challenges and there are differences in that sport. So thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.